Our presenters today are Nia Gotuther and Christina Barbicciano. Nia is a member of the Cree tribe enrolled on Turtle Mountain Reservation in North Dakota. Her specialty is teaching Native spirituality as a world religion and integrating these teachings into her academic pursuits as a traveling professor. Most recently, she created a comprehensive curriculum, 9 semester credits, about historical trauma of Indigenous people. She now works with tribal colleges to implement this curriculum because she believes that education is a step toward healing from a traumatic past. Ask Christina who she is, and she's likely to list artist, educator, and mother of two pretty amazing children, not perhaps in that order of priority. She has been a theater, art, music, and general education teacher, as well as a principal and superintendent, teaching in Pennsylvania, Vermont, New Mexico, and Montana. Christina currently serves as the volunteer education and the volunteer and education coordinator at the Museum of the Rockies here in Bozeman. Nia's portion of today's program is entitled The Sacred Return of the Buffalo. Christina's is The Benefits of Wallowing. We are most pleased to have both of them speak with us today.
Tansi? This is Cree for just a general greeting, in other words. How's it going? I love that song, All My Relations, so I'm going to greet you in that way, All My Relations. The title of my presentation is called The Sacred Return of the Buffalo. I've been studying the spirituality of Native people for more than 2 decades as an academic, and I'm honored to speak today about the buffalo, who were seen as a powerful totem by the Plains tribes. For these nature-based cultures, totems represented spiritual origins and meaning. Later on in my presentation, I will be telling the Lakota story of white buffalo calf woman. In the Native tradition, stories have power. They are a creative force. Consequently, when telling the story of white buffalo calf woman, I leave out the part where she pulverizes the guy with lustful thoughts. Even though this part of the story has particular relevance today. Need I say more? Occasionally, one sees something fleeting in the land. A moment when line, color, and movement intensify. Something sacred is revealed, leading one to believe that there is an invisible realm glimpsed now and then when the landscape speaks and we triangulate mind, body, and spirit. We become attuned. The eyes, the skin, the tongue, ears, and nostrils, all are gates where our body receives the nourishment of mystery in every gesture, wing, and shadow. For Native people, this timeless spiritual revelation and mystery was the metaphysical fabric of their lives. Ancient animals danced in dreams in the realm of the mysterious. The flit of a winged bird opened up the skies. The thunder of hooves reckoned the flow of abundance, and their absence endangered both body and spirit. They lived in eternal cyclicity. A generation of people would come and go and come again on the earth like the grass or the buffalo or the leaves on the trees, and the earth remained the same. They saw everything as having energy with its own unique intelligence, participating in this mysterious creative process. Tribes had different words for this universal energy shared by everyone and everything. In the Western Judeo-Christian tradition, there are no words equivalent in meaning to the Lakota Waka, to the Iroquois Orenda, or to the Algonquin Manitou. What comes closest in our contemporary culture to the meaning of Waka, Orenda, and Manitou is a description of the Force given by Obi-Wan Kenobi, the shamanic figure in the Star Wars films. Quote, "The Force is an energy field created by all living things. It surrounds us and penetrates us. It binds the galaxy together," unquote. When one feels this force, one begins to understand the cosmos as sacred. The buffalo were symbolic of the sacred cosmos. Their essence was incorporated into the psyche of the people so that when prairies shook with the thunderous sound of their return, it signified an ancient story made new. In acknowledgement of their life-giving sacrifice, the buffalo were given thanks in ritual acts and addressed as thou, as an equal. Stories were told in their honor so that they would live on with each telling. Today, I share with you the story of White Buffalo Calf Woman. One summer, so long ago that nobody knows how long, the Lakota Oyate, the nation, came together and camped. Every day they sent out scouts to look for game, but the scouts found nothing. Early one morning, the chief sent two of his young men to hunt for game. They decided to climb a high hill in order to get a better view. At first, they could make out only a small moving speck and had to squint to see that it was a human form. As it came nearer, they realized it was a beautiful young woman. The stranger was Betsantwi, White Buffalo Calf Woman. Her eyes shone dark and sparkling with great power in them. She was Waka, holy. She was holding a bundle and she sang as she walked slowly toward them. Ah, in this bundle is a sacred pipe, which must always be treated in a holy way. The bowl of the pipe is red stone, which represents the earth. A buffalo calf is carved in the stone facing the center and symbolizes the four-legged creatures who are your relatives. The stem is wood and represents all growing things. 12 feathers hang from the stem, and fits the bowl from the spotted eagle. These represent all the winged brothers and sisters who live among you. When you use this pipe to pray, you will pray for and with everything. This sacred pipe binds you to all of your relations, and you must remember that all people who stand on this earth are sacred. There's a commonly shared belief in Native country that a story has potency and power because it embodies the natural cycles of metamorphosis, transformation, and regeneration. We see this in the story of White Buffalo Calf Woman, who turned into a young white buffalo as she walked away, promising she would return. She shows us how natural it is to freely shift from one form to another, merging and mingling. There is no separation. That is to say, White Buffalo Calf Woman is telling us that the sacred pipe is a reminder of the power within each of us. We are the bowl, the womb giving birth. We are the sacred pipe, the stem, our axial center balanced within the cosmic energies. Our incense rises like sweet grass smoke. We are both visible and invisible. We are sacred and must open ourselves to our own story, waiting to be told. Kita tamien. Thank you.
She might not have needed that, but I need it. Thank you, Nia. It's been a real blessing to work with Nia over the last month or so and get to know her and meet with her at the Museum of the Rockies and have some conversations with her. I got to share in that blessing this morning. Thank you, Sandra, for making that connection. So my presentation is entitled The Benefits of Wallowing. And I'd like to just preface by saying that give me a room of 150 teenagers, and I'm much more comfortable in front of them than I am in front of you. So please forgive me if I stumble. Mountain plover, burrowing owl, black-footed ferret, sedge grass. What do these have in common? Their prime ecological system depends on a good wallow. Wallowing has several meanings, and it can be used as a verb and a noun. The dictionary that sits on my windowsill at home defines wallowing as, first, when speaking of chiefly large animals, toll about or lie relaxed in mud and water, especially to keep cool, avoid biting insects or spread scent. Second, if speaking of a person, to indulge in an unrestrained way in something that creates a pleasurable sensation. Kind of how I feel whenever I'm at the hot springs. But a wallow is also a noun, and it's an area of mud or shallow water where animals go to wallow, typically developing into a depression in the ground over long use. And there is no better wallower on the northern plains than the buffalo, the king of wallowing. The buffalo, or in Western scientific jargon, bison, has been on the plains of North America for millennia. And according to William Templeton Hornaday's 19th century research, there were between 25 and 30 million buffalo on this continent by the end of the 16th century. 300 years later, less than 300 years later, they were hunted to near extermination. And by 1889, there were 1,091 left, most of which were pushed into the inhospitable environment of the Yellowstone Basin. That's where we tend to go see buffalo, is at Yellowstone. But that's not their natural habitat. Colonel Dodge in 1867 famously stated, "For every buffalo dead is an Indian gone." The U.S. government and several other dark forces during this time period knew that by exterminating the buffalo, they could ostensibly exterminate native peoples, their ultimate goal. I'm going to come back to the buffalo and this difficult story in just a few moments. I came to the Museum of the Rockies in late June, excited to try a new career and direction as a volunteer and education coordinator for the museum. It's not a volunteer position, just so you know. I love the institution, its relationship with the university, and our mission. I work with and for some very smart and high-capacity people at a pretty cool place. But the Museum of the Rockies is not without its own problems, as any institution has their own strengths and challenges. And one of the challenges that Museum of the Rockies has is in its enduring people's hall, and the institution's tenuous relationship with Native peoples, both within the academic community as well as the larger Native community in Montana. We have an amazing collection of primarily Northern Plains Indian art and historical and cultural artifacts. The exhibit that showcases a very limited amount and perspective of these resources is called the Enduring Peoples Exhibit. We are blessed to be caretakers of this exhibit, but for many reasons that nobody is all too sure about articulating out in the open, this exhibit has some serious limitations. And like many Western, white-oriented institutions and museums, the exhibit has an odd and offensive way of making visitors feel like, one, Native people are all dead, and or two, Native peoples are all generally the same. I won't get into how exhibit design and curatorial perspectives can perpetuate this erroneous narrative, but I am going to tell you a little bit about how we had an opportunity to try something a little different through the Roots of Wisdom exhibit that's currently on exhibit in our changing halls. The first week I got to the Museum of the Rockies, I was tasked with creating the training and educational materials that would go along with this new exhibit that we would be mounting later in the fall. It was called Roots of Wisdom. Quote, in Roots of Wisdom, this is the marketing jargon, Native knowledge, shared science, students and families learn the ways in which traditional knowledge of indigenous communities and cutting-edge science are being applied to improve our world. The exhibit tells the stories of four Native communities, giving visitors real-life examples of how traditional knowledge and Western science provide complementary solutions to ecological and health challenges. Through the voices of elders and youth, hands-on interactives, and clever video games, which usually work, visitors gather resources, examine data, and take part in the growing movement towards sustainability and reclamation of age-old practices. Sounds good, right? Well, there's one curious problem. There was no connection whatsoever with any Native community here in Montana. So those four communities were all somewhere else. My question was, why on earth were we mounting an exhibition in Montana about Native communities doing work in other states? Where do Native peoples from Montana fit in? Where is that narrative? As usual, it was missing. There was a token attempt at including that connection through these panels, which are on display, that we were going to put on the walls that stated the Indian Education for All Act and the essential understandings that go along with that. But in my mind, this is a shallow gesture. So I started to think and think and think some more. I began to wallow in the idea that Montana has several tribes that are working very hard right here at reintroducing the buffalo to the plains ecosystem on their reservations and other tribal lands. I began to formulate a plan on creating a video or some other exhibit component that would highlight the buffalo's return and the impact this work has had on restoring the culture and economy for Native people. There was one major problem. I didn't know anything about buffalo. In fact, at this juncture, I still kept calling the animal a bison. Bison is the Western scientific name for the buffalo. Bison is the term most people use for this keystone animal, everyone except for Native peoples. A keystone species is an animal or plant that plays a unique and crucial way in which an ecosystem functions, and without keystone species, the ecosystem would dramatically be different or cease to exist altogether, which is what we found. The buffalo plays a unique role on the northern plains and prairie ecosystems. When allowed to roam and do what buffaloes do best, their activity and behavior on the landscape is intricately and completely tied to the health of the plains. When 25 to 30 million buffalo were moved from this ecosystem in a very short time period. This extermination played a violent role in the demise of the prairie ecosystem, in which the native peoples that had lived there for eons played a crucial part. The native peoples who have called the Northern Plains home since the beginning of their time know how, when, where, and why to utilize the buffalo, and the buffalo was the keystone animal for their cultural, spiritual, and economic ways of life. Fast forward to the 21st century, 300 years of a difficult and tenuous relationship between native peoples and those who came after, and there is some good news to share. Here I am, little old me doing my job, and I decide I'm going to try to learn everything I can about the buffalo and just see where the research takes me. I had the absolute blessing to speak to two important individuals in the work to conserve, expand, and reintroduce the buffalo to the plains, but also very specifically to two reservations, Fort Peck and Fort Belknap. I actually spoke to about 15 people, interviewed 15 people over a course of 2 months to get the information I needed. But to be clear, almost every tribe here in Montana has some form of buffalo restoration program. My focus was on Fort Peck and Fort Belknap, simply because that was the people I met along the way. So Fort Peck, it's home to two nations, the Sioux divisions of Sisseton, Wahpetons, and the Yanktonai, and the Hunkpapa and the Assiniboine bands of Canoe Peddler and Red Bottom. That's from their website. And like many reservations, it is a confederation and a conglomerate of several different tribes. And sometimes, historically, these are not always easy relations. Fort Peck is located in the northeast corner of Montana, just north of the Missouri River. The Fort Peck Reservation is headquartered in Poplar, Montana, and at almost 2.1 million acres, tribal members own 926,000 acres of the land. The rest is owned by the tribal council. There are 10,000 enrolled members, but only 6,000 members reside on the reservation. The Fort Peck Tribal Executive Board is guided by their current constitution, which was adopted in 1960. Many tribes, you'll find in their history, adopted a new constitution around the 60s. Forced to, actually. Fort Peck's Buffalo Restoration Project is managed by a gentleman by the name of Rob Magnan. Rob manages two Yellowstone buffalo herds as director of fish and game. The Yellowstone buffalo herd is the only genetically pure buffalo left from the extermination efforts in the 1800s. These animals are all descendants of that last 1,091 buffalo that survived in the Yellowstone Valley. The business herd, currently, has 365 adults. 89 calves were born just this spring. Through an annual lottery system, this year there will be 40 hunts allowed. People from all over the world come to hunt buffalo on that reservation, a lucrative business. The tribe also sells the meat from their annual cull, and with 27,000 fenced acres, total for buffalo, this includes a quarantine section where all new animals to the herd must live for 5 years. This is arbitrary. The tribe essentially has room for 300 animals because they have a management plan, and the management plan only allows for 170 buffalo per 12,000 acres. So the tribe creates a management plan, presents that to the state of Montana, and the state of Montana then comes in and says, you must do this and this and this in order to have the buffalo on your reservation. The tribe needs more land to utilize for their buffalo restoration efforts. I recognize that's a very controversial issue. The tribe has received donations of the genetically important Yellowstone bison from the state of Montana and Ted Turner. Their goal is to make a $250,000 profit on the business herd by 2019, and they are well on their way. Fort Belknap's buffalo restoration program is smaller, but growing. It's a little bit older. Fort Belknap Indian Reservation is home to the Gros Ventre and the Assiniboine or Nakota tribes. Fort Belknap Indian Reservation is located 40 miles south of the Canadian border and 20 miles north of the Missouri River. It's windy and cold up there in the winter. Around 8,000 tribal members live on 675,000, more or less, acres of northern plains with the Little Rocky Mountains to the south. This is perfect habitat for buffalo and their wallows. Fort Belknap was created by an act of Congress on May 1st, 1888, and established just south of Harlem, Montana. In 1888, the Blackfeet, Gros Ventre, and the Assiniboine tribes ceded 17.5 million acres of their joint reservation. They were kind of a big band of a reservation across the north of Montana, and agreed to live on three smaller reservations. These are now known as the Blackfeet, Fort Belknap, and Fort Peck reservations. Note that by 1891, so that was in 1888, but by 1891, 3 years later, there were virtually no buffalo left on the plains. And Native peoples were living in and on a landscape that was barren of food and proper water sources, as well as all the components of their cultural, social, and spiritual lives. Fort Belknap's buffalo restoration program is managed by Bronc Speak Thunder. I got to speak at length with Bronc on the phone one afternoon as he was driving around the buffalo range. He listens to country music, by the way. In order to speak with him, I had to first ask permission from the tribal council president, Mr. Azure. In fact, everything I'm sharing with you today has been approved to be shared by the native leaders that I interviewed. Fort Belknap's business herd consists of 550 adults with 200 calves born this spring. The business herd began in the 1970s when several national parks donated buffalo to the tribe. The herds roam 25,000 acres of land, so a little bit smaller, but there is a separate 1,500-acre quarantine facility for incoming buffalo, as required by the state of Montana. Their cultural herd is small, has 44 adults with 6 calves born this spring. They purchase Yellowstone buffalo cows from national parks and other organizations in the region, American Prairie Reserve, and other private entities. Fort Belknap's buffalo program partners with the American Prairie Reserve and the World Wildlife Fund to help continue purchasing more acreage and critical fencing. Good fences make good neighbors, usually. This part of the program is very controversial in rural Montana for a few reasons, mostly due to misinformation, fear, and economics. The tribe uses profits from the business herd to go back into the buffalo restoration program. So they don't, anytime they make a profit, they put it right back into the program. An interesting fact to note, the Yellowstone herd tends toward calving females. There is a critical shortage of bulls. So the tribes in the American Prairie Reserve have a bull exchange program where they rotate and share 12 bulls amongst each other in order to diversify the genetic pool. Apparently, bulls come in a dozen. I asked Bronc and Rob lots of questions about the buffalo because, remember, I really did not know anything about them. I had a presentation video to create, and I needed as much information as I could. So I learned a few fun facts. Did you know that buffalo can jump? They can jump pretty high, actually. And apparently, they are very fast runners. Their eyesight is terrible, but their sense of smell and hearing are keen and sharp. Quote, Native people call them buffaloes because only white people call them bison, or so says Rob. They also both started to describe what was happening with the landscape now that the buffalo had been on it consistently and managed properly for a decade or so. Rob especially talked about the wallows and the ecosystem around the wallows that they were finding. He described how they hadn't seen a mountain plover for many years. Mountain plover is a plump-bodied songbird with long, graceful legs that breeds only in the high plains and had used the wallows that turn into those crucial water sources in the summer of the northern prairie for food, water, and their breeding grounds. When the buffalo were removed as the keystone species, the mountain plover lost its breeding grounds. Now that the wallows were back, the tribe began seeing the mountain plover and their nests again. A bird that was on the endangered list was slowly making its way back from near extinction. Pretty amazing story. I also asked Bronk and Rob if they had any other surprises along the way as they managed their buffalo restoration programs. And they both had similar stories. They found that by bringing back the buffalo, they were starting to see their young people come back too. Their young people are being lured by the economic opportunities that the buffalo bring, managing the construction, the hunts, and the culling and manufacturing of the meat to go to market. But they are staying because they are reconnecting with the buffalo on a cultural and spiritual level, learning to use all the parts, participating in traditional rites and ceremonies, and creating new ones, seeing themselves restored in the buffalo's image. Having both herds, the business and the cultural herd, has provided opportunities for young people to see a future for themselves, economically, culturally, and spiritually. Mark Tilson, a co-founder of Tanka Meats and Native American Natural Foods, Inc. on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, summed up tribal buffalo restoration projects by saying, "We don't have room for little ideas. And if we failed, it would be what is expected." From my perspective, Fort Peck's and Fort Belknap's buffalo restoration projects are far from failing. Doesn't mean that they're not controversial, but they're not failing. They are restoring not only the buffalo, not only the wallows on the northern plains, but their sacred spirits. And they are all learning, we are all learning, that as long as the buffalo survive, the people survive.